Today's critique examines The Sovereignty of Credit, a transdisciplinary manuscript exploring how financial systems and credit operate as a constitutional power that governs our future and ecological survival. And I want to jump right into it because the manuscript introduces profoundly insightful terminology, but the density of abstract concepts occasionally obscures the immediate human stakes.
Right. Yeah, this is a crucial area to tackle right out of the gate.
Because the concepts are brilliant, right?
Oh, absolutely. Genuinely brilliant. I mean, we are looking at terms like financial autopoietization, epistemic synchronization, and temporal enclosure.
Yeah, very heavy stuff.
Very heavy. But before we can really appreciate them, we have to look at how they're actually presented on the page.
Right.
The weakness here is that the text relies, like, really heavily on these high-level philosophical abstractions throughout Part 1. And it does this without immediately mooring them to the tangible, breathing reality of what the author terms the life ground.
Which is a great term, by the way.
It is. But when you dropped that kind of dense, layered terminology on a reader without a physical anchor, you run a massive risk of alienating them, you know?
Yeah, long before they can fully grasp the systemic critique you're trying to build.
Exactly.
Let's actually, let's break down how some of these concepts work mechanically, because they are fascinating once you unpack them.
Let's do it.
Take epistemic synchronization.
Right.
On a purely mechanical level, this just means that all the major financial institutions are looking at the exact same data models, right? They're all using the same models to determine what is risky and what is valuable.
It's basically a monoculture of knowledge.
Yes, exactly. A monoculture. If every bank on Earth relies on the same algorithmic risk assessment and that one model has a blind spot,
which they always do.
Right, which they always do. Then the entire global financial system goes completely blind at the exact same time.
Right. And autopoietization functions, you know, kind of similarly. It borrows from biology, right?
The cell reproduction thing?
Yeah, the idea of a cell reproducing itself based solely on its own internal instructions. In finance, it means institutions basically close themselves off. They govern purely by internal metrics of risk and return.
Completely detaching from the physical reality they are theoretically supposed to serve.
Exactly. The math just serves the math. But, you know, explaining the definition isn't enough. The reader needs to feel it.
So a key theme running through this material seems to be that finance is essentially an invisible architecture.
Yes, absolutely.
To make this clear, I kept thinking about the financial power stack that the author outlines in the manuscript.
Oh, yeah, with the monetary, allocative, and valuation layers?
Right, and the disciplinary, infrastructural, and protective layers. I see it fundamentally as a computer's operating system.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, just as an OS silently dictates which software can run, how memory is allocated, and you know, which programs get priority during a system crash, the credit constitution dictates which human futures get installed.
Right, installed. I see what you did there.
If a community doesn't meet the algorithmic requirements of that financial operating system, their future simply fails to boot up. The rules are written in the background, entirely invisible to the user.
That's fascinating. What are the potential limitations or counterarguments to that idea?
Well, what do you mean?
Because while the operating system analogy helps clarify the hidden structural nature of the stack, there is a risk that it makes the system sound, I don't know, a bit too clean?
Too clean?
Yeah, too digital. Unlike a software glitch on your laptop, these financial structures extract a brutal toll on physical bodies and ecosystems.
Oh, right.
A computer crashing just means a blank screen. A financial system crashing, or even just operating as designed against a vulnerable population, means a hospital losing power.
Yeah, that's a very fair point.
It means a coastline being swallowed by rising tides because a nation is trapped in refinancing dependency and literally can't afford to build seawalls.
I hear you. But think of it less like an OS running a laptop and more like an operating system running a pacemaker.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
If that specific code encounters an error, the physical heart stops beating. The abstract code is directly plugged in flesh and blood.
That is terrifying, but much more accurate.
But your larger point stands entirely. The author's abstract language must be aggressively humanized. We cannot let the reader lose sight of the physical consequences of these financial codes.
Exactly. And the fix for this is actually structural within the prose itself.
How so?
Well, if I'm the author, I'm anchoring every single major theoretical coinage with an immediate grounded illustration.
Right.
The author actually sets up a beautiful Caribbean and small island context in the prologue. You know, that vivid picture of a hurricane's aftermath?
Oh, where the state has a flag and a parliament, but absolutely zero financial capacity to rebuild?
Because of external currency dependence.
Yes, that exact one. That lens should be used continuously. Every time a piece of jargon is introduced, it needs to be immediately translated through that hurricane.
Let's visualize how that could work on the page.
Okay.
Obviously, these are just a handful of ways to approach this out of dozens of possibilities, but imagine taking that definition of autopoetization and immediately following it with a vignette.
Right. Bring it to life. Picture a specific local hospital on that devastated island being shuttered to meet a fiscal debt target set by a distant creditor.
Yeah.
The physical reality is undeniable, right? The hospital's standing, the doctors are ready, the patients are bleeding.
But the financial code cannot process that physical reality.
Exactly. It can only process the debt-to-GDP ratio, so the system shuts the hospital down. The cell reproduces its own internal logic and completely ignores the bleeding patient.
Yes. And you could do the exact same thing for epistemic synchronization.
How would you do that one?
Point to a specific scenario where that shared, you know, international climate risk model fundamentally fails to account for the hurricane's true economic fallout in a vulnerable coastal fishing community.
Oh, right, because all the banks are looking at the exact same flawed synchronized model.
Exactly. So that entire community is deemed unbankable overnight. They can't get loans for new boats. They can't rebuild the docks.
Just cut off completely.
By pinning these massive, somewhat intimidating philosophical concepts directly to the hurricane prologue, the reader feels the actual weight of the theory.
And I think once that abstract language is firmly grounded in physical reality, the reader is going to be significantly better prepared to follow the author on what is, frankly, a very ambitious, complex historical journey.
Which brings us right to the structural flow of the piece.
Yes. The manuscript builds a towering conceptual architecture in the opening chapters, yet the sudden pivot to the history of merchant credit risks disorienting the reader.
Yeah. The transition between part one and part two is where we definitely hit a bit of a structural wall.
A big one.
In part one, the reader is completely immersed in this highly abstract contemporary framework. I mean, we are dissecting the bleeding edge of the financial power stack.
We are looking at artificial intelligence, digital sovereign money, shadow banking, all the mechanics of modern central bank liquidity.
And then you turn the page.
Yep.
And suddenly we cross the boundary into part two, and we are thrust into the literal historical mechanics of pre-modern bills of exchange.
14th century merchant credit.
Yeah, the financing of medieval long-distance trade. The shift feels incredibly abrupt.
It really does. The thematic tissue connecting these two sections is quite thin right now.
And because of that, the historical deep dive risks feeling like a detour, or worse, like it belongs to a completely different book.
Right. A reader who is deeply invested in the modern crisis of ecological survival might easily just lose the plot while reading about medieval money changers assessing the metallic content of silver coins in some piazza.
Exactly.
Okay, so what I really like about this part is just how incredibly thoroughly the author traces the evolution of money changing and merchant law.
Oh, the mechanics are fascinating when you dig into them.
Right. The author explains how a merchant in Florence could hand over funds to a local banker and in return receive a coded piece of paper authorizing payment in Bruges, like hundreds of kilometers away.
We really have to remember how revolutionary this was at the time.
Absolutely. Before this, if you wanted to buy wool in another country, you had to physically pack chests full of heavy, easily stolen gold and silver.
Put them on a cart.
Yeah, put them on a cart and just hope you weren't robbed by bandits on the road.
Right. It was a massive logistical and physical risk. The bill of exchange allowed trust and purchasing power to be transported across highly fragmented political jurisdictions without ever moving a single physical coin.
Exactly. It's a masterclass in financial history. It essentially created a shadow network of trust that existed entirely on paper ledgers.
It is beautifully researched, there's no question about that. But is the connection between A and B fully established in the material, or is that an area to potentially bolster?
That's the million-dollar question.
Because while the history of the medieval bill of exchange is undeniably fascinating on its own merits, we have to question whether the reader will instinctively understand why they are reading about 14th century trade routes right after learning about contemporary algorithmic central banking.
Yes, without highly explicit guidance from the author, the reader might view these historical chapters as just an academic tangent,
rather than recognizing them as the very foundation of the core argument.
I can see what you're going for here. The reader is asking, why am I in the 14th century when we were just talking about climate change and AI?
Exactly.
We need to strengthen this structural bridge. The author shouldn't just recount the history sequentially. They need to frame this history as the gradual, centuries-long assembly of the modern machine.
Yes.
We need a thematic tether that explicitly links the historical narrative backward to the six specific theoretical layers of the stack that were just painstakingly introduced in part one.
The reader needs to see that history is literally just the stack being built, piece by piece, layer by layer, over hundreds of years.
Right.
The 14th century isn't a detour, it's the laying of the foundational code for that operating system you mentioned earlier.
So how do we actually execute that thematic tethering on the page?
Well, there are a few ways.
Again, looking at just a few options out of many, the author could frame the opening of the merchant credit chapter explicitly through the lens of temporal sovereignty.
Oh, that concept introduced in part one.
Exactly. Show the reader how that pre-modern letter of credit wasn't just a convenient way to avoid bandits, it was humanity's first major technological leap in converting anticipated future flows of trade into present purchasing power.
It was the invention of borrowing against the future on a transnational scale.
I mean, that's huge.
I love that. Or take the concept of infrastructural power from the stack model.
How would that fit?
The author could add a framing paragraph to part two, stating directly how these early paper-based banking networks were the first rudimentary iterations of the infrastructural power we see today in systems like SWIFT or digital payment rails.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's the exact same mechanism of control, just upgraded from paper ledgers to fiber optic cables.
Precisely. By explicitly naming the layers of the stack as they emerge in history,
showing how allocative power began with merchant accounting networks.
Right, and evolved into today's centralized liquidity. The reader is constantly reminded of the stakes.
Yeah, they realize they aren't just reading a history of banking. They are tracing the genealogy of the very monster that is currently enclosing their future.
And understanding how that historical trap was built, brick by brick over centuries, is exactly what makes the reader feel so utterly imprisoned by it today.
Which poses a massive challenge for the final sections of the manuscript.
It really does. If the system is this deeply entrenched, how do we possibly get out of it?
The vision for a life-coherent credit constitution provides a beautiful normative horizon, yet the practical mechanism for transitioning to this system remains somewhat opaque in the early diagnosis.
This is a critical issue of pacing and, frankly, of hope.
It really is. The manuscript thoroughly and masterfully dissects what it calls claim governance and its inherently extractive nature.
It meticulously details how financial claims continuously demand that the living world adjust to meet the needs of the balance sheet.
It's this terrifying idea of temporal enclosure, where our future ecological capacity is preemptively assigned to service financial debts.
The analysis is ironclad.
It is. However, it leaves the reader waiting literally hundreds of pages to see how existing institutions can actually be reformed to adopt life credit principles.
Right. The deep, heavy focus on the diagnosis of our current extractive system makes the eventual solution feel distant, highly theoretical, and almost impossible to reach.
The material makes a strong case for this extraction by highlighting how deeply embedded things like refinancing dependency, unequal collateralization, and the global monetary hierarchy are in our daily lives.
The author proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the modern system is perfectly designed to preserve financial claims above human life.
But there is a danger here.
Definitely. When you build a case that strong and that impenetrable, you run the risk of inducing absolute fatalism in your audience.
Oh, absolutely. Anyone who reads heavy macroeconomic theory knows that feeling of reaching page 300 and thinking, well, the system is rigged from the 14th century to today, so the world is just doomed.
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of the hopeful reader?
The hopeful reader?
Yeah. What if we looked at it from the perspective of that hopeful reader who picked up the book looking for a way out?
Right. They don't want to just be told how bad it is.
Exactly. That reader desperately wants to know that change is possible now, in this current reality. not just in some theoretical utopia where all global financial architecture has magically been rewritten from scratch.
They need to know that life credit, you know, credit that actually enables future life capacity to exceed the obligations created in financing it, is something that can exist in the world we currently inhabit.
It's a heavy lift, though. How do we restructure the manuscript to serve that hopeful reader without diluting the power of the systemic critique?
You have to pull a microcosm of the constructive alternative forward.
Into the early chapters?
Yeah. Part 7 outlines this incredible alternative constitution, but the author needs to pull fragments of that into the prologue or the very early chapters.
I see.
By teasing the practical, real-world solutions early on, the author proves to the reader that this transformation is fundamentally feasible today.
You don't have to explain the entire architecture of the alternative constitution up front.
No, but you have to plant the seeds. You have to show the reader that this monolithic financial stack actually has cracks in it, and that life-coherent finance is already sprouting in those cracks.
That makes perfect sense. Let's think about how to manifest that early in the text.
Okay.
One approach, and again, this is just a starting point for the author to consider, is to briefly profile a current public cooperative bank, or a community lender, right there in the prologue or chapter one.
Oh, I like that.
Show us an institution that is already using life capacity metrics rather than standard algorithmic risk models.
Right. Show the reader a bank that evaluates a loan not based on how much extractive collateral the borrower can pledge, but on whether the proposed project restores a local watershed or builds resilient non-speculative housing.
Yes. Show us the alternative functioning in reality.
Or tie it back to our Caribbean hurricane example from earlier.
Oh, how would that work?
Introduce a real-world, mission-oriented investment fund operating in the Caribbean right alongside the critique of the current stack.
Oh, that's powerful.
If the prologue sets up the devastation of a hurricane and the absolute paralysis of standard sovereign debt, immediately counter that dark image with a localized working example of life credit stepping in to rebuild without demanding extractive austerity.
By showing a working alternative early on, you give the reader a concrete anchor of hope.
You give them the emotional stamina required to wade through hundreds of pages of heavy systemic critique.
They are willing to look into the abyss of claim governance because they know exactly what kind of future we are fighting to build.
And they know that future is actually possible.
It changes the entire emotional trajectory of the reading experience.
It really does. It shifts the book from being a chronicle of inevitable doom into a roadmap for a difficult but entirely possible reconstruction.
It empowers the reader rather than just overwhelming them.
Exactly.
Well, this has been a deeply engaging analysis of a truly monumental piece of work.
It has.
To quickly recap our three main takeaways for the author. First, anchor your abstract jargon like autopoetization and epistemic synchronization with tangible flesh-and-blood examples from the life ground.
Heavily utilize that Caribbean hurricane context to show the physical stakes of the financial code.
Second, use the six layers of the financial power stack as explicit connective tissue transitioning into the historical chapters.
Show the reader exactly how 14th century merchant credit built the infrastructural and allocative powers we are trapped by today.
And third, introduce concrete real-world examples of life credit institutions early in the text to ground the theoretical solutions.
Provide your reader with a vital anchor of hope before diving into the diagnosis.
The manuscript is incredibly strong as it stands, and the theoretical framing is top tier.
We highly encourage the author to take these actionable suggestions to heart, and we would absolutely love to invite you to submit your revised work back to the critique as the manuscript evolves and gets closer to publication.
When we started, we looked at the financial operating system as an invisible architecture, silently installing futures in the background while the physical world bears all the consequences.
Right.
By grounding these abstract concepts in human reality, linking the ancient historical code directly to the modern machine, and showing us early on that new, life-serving operating systems are already being built, this manuscript has the power to do something profound.
It really does.
It won't just describe the crash of our current system, it will actually write the code for our recovery.